Hey, this is Soma 79 with a special announcement. My new Mega Mix is up. My MF Doom Mega Mix, Oxidation Moonsday, is now available. Go to www.soma79.com/doom to check it out. It's a 30-minute mix that I did of MF Doom raps over my own beats. I really enjoy it. I hope you really enjoy it. So check it out. Tell a friend. Peace. Hey, welcome to the newest episode of the Articulate Ox Podcast. I am your host, Soma79. Thank you so much for joining me today. Man, my guest today, Paul Cantor, the author of Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. This is a great episode, so much so that I've decided to turn it into the first two-part episode of the Articulate Ox Podcast. I had scheduled an hour for Paul and I to talk. We ended up talking for 2 hours, and I think it's really a really informative interview. We get into some details about Mac's life, some stuff that I didn't know, some stuff that maybe you don't even know, even if you're a big Mac fan. So definitely check out this book. As soon as I read it, I knew Paul was somebody that I wanted to talk to, and I highly recommend you check out this book. He tells a great story about how just the response to this book fulfilled this desire he had as a child. And I don't know, he's a really informative guy. He talks about how he's interviewed other people like Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole and Suge Knight. And we didn't even get into too much of that because there was so much interesting stuff about Mac to talk about. We talk about the movie Kids and the influence it had on me in particular and just his thoughts of it. And I don't know, Paul's a great guy. I'd encourage you to check out this book and check out pretty much any of his writing. So if you enjoy this episode, make sure you tune in next week for part two of my interview with Paul Cantor, and definitely check out his book, Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. While you're at it, check out some of my music, soma79.com, and actually I have a Bandcamp now, soma79.bandcamp.com. I'm selling some of my music, I'm selling some stickers, and I'm gonna have, I actually got an LP, some vinyl coming out in the not too distant future, probably not by the time this album comes out, but in the next few months. I got some CDs and stuff too, so check that out, soma79.bandcamp.com, but especially check out Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller, and all of Paul Cantor's other readings. So, all right, have a good one. Peace.
Wings clipped, quick to flip manuscripts, cause her man went from damaged kid to damn he's rich, but she still can't stand the way he manages to never put nickels in the can for the cancer kid.
Alright, welcome to the newest episode of the Articulate Ox Podcast. I'm your host, Soma79. Thank you for joining me. My guest today is the author of one of my favorite music books from the past couple years, Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. I think it's the first book written about Mac Miller, and your first book, Paul Cantor. How are you doing today, man?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. So I was so excited when this book came out. I have to admit, I'm one of those people. I'm on the older side. I'm turning 45 this year. And my first exposure to Mac Miller was hearing about him using I think it was a Diamond D or Lord Finesse beat, I think, off of the Kids album. Frozen Pizza and Kool-Aid song. I'm so bad with song names.
Kool-Aid and Frozen Pizza.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And so like I got in my underground hip hop about that. I'm like, fuck this dude. I'm like, this is it. And then like I sort of just checked out for years. And then I have to admit, it was right before he passed that I started getting to be a fan of him. And then it was like instantly he was gone. So for me, this was really, for someone who I'd sort of missed a lot of, you know, him actually in real life, this book was super valuable, and it was such an enriching experience. So what led you to want to write about Mac?
Well, I mean, actually, your opening comments actually were part of the reason why I was inspired to write the book. I think that a lot of people may have knew who he was or had some reaction to some of his music, you know, and you know, before he passed, some negative, some positive, maybe knew a little bit of who he was, but didn't really know the, you know, finer details, a lot of which even I didn't know. And I knew certain, you know, aspects of his career. I knew that he had, quote unquote, like, you know, really bled for the art and put a lot into it. He seemed like a fairly misunderstood character in the sense that he was a little bit of, you know, an outsider in the hip hop space. He was criticized a little bit for, you know, maybe being a white rapper or the type of music that he was, you know, making at that time. And that criticism obviously, you know, played a big role in some of how his life unfolded in his career. And yeah, he just seemed like a little bit of a misunderstood genius. He also had a very passionate fan base that was extremely dedicated to pretty much everything he had ever done. People were obsessed with this guy, and that obsession too was something I was curious about. Like, you know, I could understand being a fan of somebody, but I wanted to know a little bit more about what it was that made people connect so deeply with someone, you know, to where they would get tattoos and, you know, they would, you know, buy all this merch and be so passionate about him, you know. And yeah, that was really kind of fascinating to me as well. Because, like, you know, I was familiar with his music and I thought he was hitting like a creative peak toward the end of his life. But I, you know, I wasn't 100% like sure what exactly was that magnetic thing that would make a person, you know, almost like dedicate their entire life to them, like be a quote unquote stan, you know?
Which is funny, because that's how he landed on my radar, is because I'd go to this coffee shop. I'll give her a shout out, this young lady, Jackie, owns the Coffee Loft in Marlboro, Massachusetts, and I went in there all the time. She was always playing Mac Miller, and she's like, you got to check out this Mac Miller doing House of the Rising Sun. And I was like, wow, this dude's really talented. And I was just like, he totally like opened my eyes to just what an amazing and like a generational talent. And it's funny, I was thinking about him a little bit today, and there's a saying at if you've ever been to Hollywood Studios at Disney, their slogan is, we welcome you to a Hollywood that never was and always will be. And when I think of Mac Miller, it's sort of, his music reminds me of a childhood I had that never was but always will be. Like even though he's probably close to 20 years or 15 years younger than me, he's feel like he's talking about a childhood that I totally relate to, yet was totally different from mine. And I think that might be part of the appeal of him, is that his message is somehow universal. It's like him somehow being kind of out of place, it seems, almost everywhere he went, we're not fully understood, somehow I think made him more understood to the masses to some degree.
Yeah, that's a point I would concede. Yeah, I think you're hitting on something fairly. I think that's a fairly introspective point, you know, in terms of how a person connects to something, right, and how a person relates to something. It's like a music that is so specific enough that you identify, but so at the same time, a little vague in certain spots to where it leaves a lot of room for interpretation. But that's what great art does, right? It allows you to project a little bit of your own reality into the picture, right? And, you know, some writers are so great, you know what I mean? They're painting a picture that you can't really see yourself in, you know, maybe like a Nas, for example, you know, right, his type of writing, you know, it's almost like a hyper realism, you know, you feel like you're at the window with him while he's writing it, but you don't necessarily see yourself in that scenery. Yeah, you know, you're more so, it's more so like a,
it's like I got the brown dots in it. Nobody in my block's got one. I can picture the dots in, but I don't picture myself in it, you know?
It's almost like a movie, you know what I mean? Yes. That is being scripted. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, some of Mac's music, at least his earlier music, you know, it's very, has like a youthful charm and exuberance and a little bit of like a...
Oh, I just graduated high school. Like,
yeah. I think also, like, too, there's a little bit of a lack of filter in that stuff. And that too is like, it doesn't feel tailored, to anything, right? It just feels like a person who's kind of like writing their experience. And usually, like, this is my belief, I don't know this to be true. It's just a just my theory. But people typically connect with like energy, right? And if you go in the studio with a lot of energy and it's kind of bursting out of you when you do it, it kind of bleeds into the record. And usually when the record comes out, there's like this sort of frenetic energy that is just it's just an X factor, right? And that's usually why an artist's first album is so good, or they're like early mixtapes, because there's no filter yet. They're not really,
They're dancing like nobody's
it,
looking to some degree.
right. There's no exterior forces shaping them, right, other than their life experience up until that point, and so it's kind of raw. And like, yeah, people, they fuck with that, yeah. So I think that's what initially got him attention. And then, over time, right, it was like, about an 8 year period of really like a professional career where, there's a lot of like development. And he obviously has a fairly diverse catalog,
8 years, this much vinyl. That's a pretty big career, like for a short period of time.
That's cool that you have, all the records.
Once I'm a bit of a collector, and once I get into one artist, I'm like, I kind of want all of them because I want to sit down and listen from beginning to end, which I haven't done yet with him, but I plan on doing that when I have, a couple days. But
Yeah, I think his catalog of like official releases is fairly interesting to listen to them in succession. And one thing that I've had a lot of people tell me about the book is that they like to read the book while they're listening to the music.
I did a little of that
So
too.
they'll maybe like, read a little bit, a chapter or two. And because it is not like it's the hardest book to read, it's not like Ulysses or something, you know what I'm saying? Right? Like you can kind of get through it pretty quickly. And intentionally it's written that way. It's written in a way so that you can digest it. But you could read a chapter or two and then you could kind of like play the music, for a day, 2 days, and then at the end of 2 days, you go back and you read another two chapters. It's gonna take you what, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it's not that long, you know what I'm saying? So it's a little bit of a good companion for that.
So in terms of the writing process, where were you mentioned that I saw an article that you got a chance to meet Mac during one of the early record release parties or something in New York City. You got a chance to talk to him for a few minutes. Was that your first I think that was around 2011 that that album came out. Was that your first real exposure to him? Where did your interest really draw from? Would you follow him this whole time, or?
Well, in the book, there's an author's note where I kind of like introduce the book a little bit and what my connection is. And I actually was somebody who very early in his career, he really didn't even have a career yet. He was just kind of like a kid on the internet that his first record label, they were thinking about working with him and they asked my opinion, on what I thought about him. So I remembered sitting in my apartment. I was living in Staten Island at the time. That's where I'm from. And
Wu
I was
Tang.
in my, huh?
Wu Tang. Wu Tang forever.
I was in Staten Island in my apartment, and I got like an instant message. Maybe it was GChat, who knows, from somebody from his label, and they were sending me a YouTube clip of him, and they were like, well, what do you think of this? And he was rapping in the video, and I was like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Yeah, I think this kid is a talented kid. At the time, there were some white rappers who were making inroads they were becoming more, commonplace, I suppose. They were always white rappers, underground rappers.
But like the Paul Walls, like Eminem had already been big for a while, like even Macklemore and people like that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know the time where I got all that.
even when I think of like white rappers, I think more of like Jedi Mind Tricks
Yeah, Vinny Paz,
and Vinny
Esoteric.
Paz, yeah, like stuff like that. And Atmosphere, you know what
Yeah.
I'm saying? Like that type of shit. And but this was a little different in the sense that it was somebody that was kind of like you could tell a little bit influenced by that music, but their intention was not necessarily to make music for the audience that would typically listen to that, right? It was more like, how can I take something that's a little bit of a backpacky, throwbacky type thing and maybe give it to a more urban audience, a little younger, a little less like we, sit around on Hip Hop Infinity and undergroundhiphop.com, like digesting all this stuff, right? And I thought that was kind of cool, and I just was like, yeah, man, you should work with this kid. And they did, right? So pretty much throughout his whole career, I always knew what was going on with him because I always had the relationship with them. And that relationship was very, personal in the sense that they would kind of tell me things that nobody else knew about what was going on. And it was just us talking as like professional acquaintances, but also friends. So they would say, oh, Mac is doing this, Mac's doing that. We just got this. I kind of like knew what he was getting, even for like a show, how much he was getting paid, different mixtapes and things that were like on the horizon. I kind of was being fed that information. So I was a journalist, right? And, it was like, there was always this potential that I would write about him in some kind of meaningful way. That never happened because you really need an opportunity to do it. It's not like a person can just go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
You need a publication that wants you to do it.
Timing has to be right and paths have to cross and,
But of the big hip hop people, whether it's Kendrick Lamar or J. Cole, Nas, I've interviewed all these people. You know what I mean? Like at some point or another, the circumstances of my professional career have, linked me with them.
Hip hop gets to
Anybody
be, it's a small world once you get into it. It's
you
like,
can think of, literally anybody you can think of, there are people who there are books on them. Jeezy, Scarface, all these people, Lil Wayne. I've interviewed all these people, So Snoop Dogg, like you just name them. So it was inevitable that I would at some point do something, a large in scope on him. And I also always, read the things that came out on him. Like, I always read the press coverage. I kind of stayed up on what he was doing. And I would see even people I knew, they were peers or whatever, they would do articles on him. And I would always kind of check it out because I just thought he was an interesting guy. Yeah, I was very, the fact that he passed like was in and of itself, the response to it was like kind of a little weird, because I saw him kind of being, what's that Biggie song, right? It's like you're nobody until somebody
Nobody
kills you.
kills you.
I kind of like had a little bit of that, vibe, or the Jadakiss, that rappers get better promotion, right? It was like something was like a little off in the response, and I was just like, whoa, did I, I kind of was seeing the a little bit of like a sad character, like the, this sort of like emo thing that was being latched onto.
Because this was
And
right
for
after the Tiny Desk concert came out, right? Didn't he pass
yes.
away? And it was like that, the 2009. I think that's a very that song for me is very mel. It really brings me to a place, and that's a song that can definitely bring some tears out of me. And so I think it was maybe part of that being one of the most recent memories of him too, that it was seemed almost fitting, you know.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of a melancholy that was sort of pulsing through that last record. And
Yeah.
obviously, if you listen to it, I mean, there's a lot of
Pain.
fairly vague but personal, like ideas being expressed in there. And I mean, that's kind of colored and illustrated throughout most of his music, but you listen to that record a little bit and in retroactively, after he passes away, and you're like, whoa, this is a little bit of like a eerie record,
Yeah.
it's be kind of like has this vibe of like, if I am to die, this is my last statement, right? And
Yeah.
there's a lot of that
Even
on
how
there.
exhausted he looks on the cover, where he's just like,
Yes,
you
it's a little
know.
bit like, I'm spent.
Yeah.
And listen, I know that feeling, right? That's how I felt when I finished this book.
Yeah, bet.
I was just like, yeah, if I was to die here, I mean, I gave it my all, that type of thing,
Yeah.
and you are at when you come to the end of these things, and when you have a certain kind of personality where you obsess over stuff. It takes a lot out of you, and
Yeah.
it will slowly drive you crazy,
Been there. Yep.
Yeah.
I've been working on a film that's been doing that to me the past few years.
So it'll
It'll drive you nuts if they let you.
you go to sleep with it at night, you wake up with it in the morning, you have a lot of voices in your head, and things that are driving you crazy.
Becomes almost
Music.
a telltale heart. Like when I'm laying in bed and I think about just, you know, the footage down in my office, I can almost hear a tick like Poe, you know? Like
Yeah,
it's
I
gonna
know.
kill me if I don't kill it.
Exactly. It's very. I think with music though, music has a very. It's very easy to lose your mind, with music, because it's a little bit less of an eye thing and it's more of an ear thing, and you have to listen very carefully to small nuances in sound, very tiny things, just a changing of frequencies on sounds and how things blend together.
And your
And your
ears get
ears,
tired fast, especially as you get
yes,
older. You can't trust your ears for too long.
no, it's partially it's that when you're under the influence of something, things sound one way. Then you come back to it, you're like, what the hell was I
Yeah.
thinking? you know what I'm saying? And also the technology that is available to musicians allows for, an infinite set of creations. You can literally take a song and sit there tweaking it for, a year and just adding on top of it. It's not like a thing where there's a limitation,
Right. You're not using tape and you're like limited to like, you know.
Exactly. You don't you it, with tape, you were paying for it, right? A reel to reel in and of itself, just one reel was kind of expensive. Whereas technology now is relatively inexpensive, and you can work on these things like endlessly, right? And
Yeah.
so, nothing is ever f finished. That's why Kanye, he puts out albums and then he
Still
updates the
tweaking it.
album, right? Because
Yeah.
he's like, I hear something in this thing I want to change.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many people who want to do that over the years. It's like you don't blame them for doing it. I mean, you can blame them for a lot of things, but I don't blame them for doing that, you know?
I mean, a good example of this where it can kind of it get a little ridiculous is with film, right? You have two great filmmakers, Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, right? Coppola changes his movies all the time. There's like a million cuts of The Godfather, Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse
There's like
Now.
17
Yeah.
versions of that, right?
Yeah.
And
You're like, Harrison
whereas,
Ford, was he always in this movie?
exactly, it's great. You're like, there's all kinds of scenes that are being added. You're like, where did this even come from?
Yeah.
Now, when you're editing a movie, right, you know, right, you're a filmmaker, so the pacing and everything is so important. You know, the edit is like an art unto itself. You start adding things back, the pacing gets all out of whack. Now you're like, there's a movie that was perfect, you know, at 140 minutes or whatever, and now all of a sudden you added this 12 minutes, and it just throws the whole thing off. Whereas like Martin Scorsese, he says the print is the print, right? I'm never changing it, and I don't think he ever has, you know. So there's different philosophies with it, right?
I mean, it's looking backwards, looking versus looking forward to some degree. And I think in some ways we're all fighting that, the some people want to spend more time looking backwards and some people want to spend more time looking forward,
Totally. It's just like I said, with music, the ability to do it is just so great. It's so much easier than anything, you know. I think it's easier than with film. You know, it's just it's so easy to just open up your laptop and start playing with a Pro Tools session or an Ableton Live session and start tweaking things. You know, the tech is kind of like right there with you. And
Like two weeks.
obviously you can do that with like, you know, editing programs, you know, with films as well, you know. But it's a little, I feel like it's a little more, yeah, something
Well,
about
even
that
like a video
connection
file is
here.
like 10 times bigger than an audio file. So it's like, even like, when I'm done with these podcasts, I'm downloading the files. If it was a song, it would take 2 seconds, but everything takes longer with video and just the concern of how it looks and all that stuff. And it's a whole different,
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing podcasts, I just would never edit them. I would like record them, and I just say, I'm just too lazy. They just put it up with all the mistakes and everything. Granted, that was a few years ago, when podcasts were a little different. You know, now you got to be, you know, a little more professional.
Well, it's funny too. I was thinking about this with Mac, where he, I think of people like Tupac and Biggie, and I often forget how young they were when they passed. Because you listen to some of the things they were talking about, and I compare to where I was when I was their age, and it's pretty remarkable that somebody at 23 and 24 is writing these songs. And Mac Miller is the same way. I mean, when you compare him with other rappers you've talked to, do you feel that there was something that was just natural to him? Like, do you feel there was something common with him with the people like the Kendricks and the J. Coles and the Nas's and those types?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, he's like a definitely a special, you know, writer, for sure. And if he wasn't, I don't think it wouldn't have made sense to even do a book on him, you know, just because the I would be kind of like writing about nothing. What I would be lying. You know, basically, I would be like trying to create a story out of nothing, you know. And to me, you know, I think one of the interesting things that in the development of his music was, and this is very reflective of his age, I don't think he had yet really made it to the point of writing about someone else. A lot of, you know, his writing is mostly about himself, maybe a little bit about things he would see. And in the earlier part of his career, and he talks about this, and I talk about it in the book, you know, is he was definitely very influenced in a lot of things he was writing about by things he was doing with his friends. But he, you know, because of his age, you know, a 25-year-old, a 24-year-old, a 23-year-old, they're still kind of like in me world, you know. You get to like 30 or so, even you get to your late 20s, your life starts, you know, you start looking outward a lot more. And I think he was starting to get to that point a little bit. He does talk about it in some interviews, and you know, and I talk about it in the book, that he had at a certain point felt that he'd kind of like run out of things to talk about, you know, that he had I think his actual quote is, I'd run out of life to write about. Which I thought was like kind of fascinating,
Right.
and in a certain, sense, he had already run out of life to write about, but when you're on substances, that allows you to almost tap into some element, right, of yourself that you can't even see. So now you have the sub element of your own psyche, right, that's being revealed through these substances, and then you have your journey with the substances, right, which in and of itself is a, is a little bit of a narrative, right, that you
Right.
can
It's a hat
sort
on a
of.
hat to some degree.
Yes, so there was a lot of that, say between the ages of like, I don't know, 21 and say, 24, 25, and then, there's a little period where he's kind of out of it and he's almost, picks this subject. Okay, I'm going to make an album about love, and there's like an sort of R&B influenced album, which is the Divine Feminine. And
Right.
that album is very non-specific when you listen to it. It has a certain thing where it's a little vague in certain spots. You don't really know who or what he's talking about, and it's just a different type of it's just a different type of writing. But I always, when I re reviewed his second album for Vibe,
Which
that
one was
was
this?
one.
Which one is the second? Because I always get confused what's a mixtape and what's an album.
That was watching movies with the sound
Oh,
off.
that's actually, I think, probably that and Macadelic are probably my two favorites.
Right. That album, I actually felt that that was actually, one of my criticisms of that album was that it was not specific enough. It was kind of like, I can see that this person is dealing with something and they're clearly ornery about a thing,
Yeah.
but they don't want to really name it, for lack of, I don't want to use the word lack. It's more like a, sometimes if you're very specific about what's bothering you, you're gonna kind of tap a vein that is a little too uncomfortable to deal with,
Right.
right? And so that was maybe, it was my theory about that album was like, yeah, this is a guy's maybe, yeah, maybe he's indulging in some things a little too much. And he's being like affected by it. Obviously the music industry is, affecting him as well. He'd received a lot of criticism for his first album, so
Yeah.
now he's got this like chip on his shoulder. But it's like, it
And he
was a
made it
little
in
bit,
this really dark hole, like.
yes. And it was like I felt that it was the work of somebody who was trying very hard to do something, and it was like you want an E for effort,
Right.
right? It's
Well, you know
like,
what?
and
I had this line in the song I wrote recently where it's like, I can't lie to myself and be honest with you. And it kind of feels like he maybe is lying to himself a little bit about where he's at in his life, but he's trying to be honest, but the effort of trying to be honest almost makes it a lie to some degree. Like it's just like maybe he just wasn't there yet, like with the maturity level of to know thyself,
exact know thyself, right? Exactly. I mean, and it's look, it's a lot to ask for a person at that age, right?
Yeah.
To confront those things. I mean, there's people out here who are 40 plus who aren't really being honest with themselves,
Right.
about you can go your whole life without really acknowledging, what that you have daddy issues or some untapped trauma that, that occurred to you, right? And that's what, I guess people mean when they say, you have some demon, right? It's
Yeah.
a thing that's kind of like haunting you, right?
Well, even like the cover, he's there naked, but he doesn't look comfortable. He looks so uncomfortable. The look in his eyes is just like he almost looks a little like dead to some degree, but he's also burying himself completely. It's like a dichotomy,
Yes, I mean the artwork, on a lot of his albums is pretty, fascinating. It's kind of like its own, it's its own little thing that can be analyzed, right? Of
Yeah.
like what does this mean? But I call it, I think that was a cool thing, I think his brother designed the album cover, and I think his mother shot the photography, and so yeah, I mean they did a good job with it.
Yeah, I mean his everything too. I mean his I've always thought his merchandising looked really good. Like he always had a very cool style to him. I think part of it is, I mean, you mentioned Atmosphere before. I've always considered them one of the biggest underground hip hop bands, and it's probably no secret that one of the reasons is they appeal to women as well as they appeal to men. It's like there's some sex appeal to Slug, that women go nuts for. And I think with Mac Miller there's a similar thing. And it's like obviously he's a good-looking kid, I can't feel old just calling him a kid, but he was a good looking guy. And that's certainly not going to hurt you with the ladies, but sometimes it might hurt your credibility to some degree, where it's like, nobody wants to be the attractive stand-up comedian doesn't get as many laughs,
Well, that is an interesting point. Yes, you do get some points taken away from you, right? If you look a certain way, right? Here's a great example. Imagine Ryan Seacrest didn't look like Ryan Seacrest, right? It's just Ryan Seacrest looks a certain way, right? So he kind of And I'm not saying this in any to take anything away from Ryan Seacrest, but he has a little bit of like an LA look, maybe it could be perceived as a little, douchey or whatever, right?
Like, well, I bet when you met him, you'd be really shocked at just how thin his waist really is, like, and how tailored
You're
his.
just like, how can a person look this good and be such a nerd,
Right, and
you know,
never
at such
stop working. Now he's
yeah,
doing Wheel of Fortune.
But whenever I hear Ryan Seacrest, I'm always like, if I don't imagine Ryan Seacrest, I'm always impressed by what he's doing. He always asks good questions. He has pretty interesting insights. You're like, why am I holding it against him that he
Right.
looks this way,
He's a
right?
calorie burner. The guy could be sitting on his ass, but he's not. He's always like,
Right. So it's the same way, I think. With the even with the like. The Lord Finesse, situation that I talk about in the book where Lord Finesse, sued him and everything. I have to believe that, some of that was just rooted in, obviously, people want to get compensated for their work.
Right.
But I think some of it was also rooted in like, this is just like a corny white kid,
Right.
and like, you can't. You're not going to profit off of my material being such a, like a whatever it is you might perceive him as, you know what I'm saying? And I think that, yeah, if you could kind of take that away, and just judge it on its own merits, you would kind of feel differently. How people look, I mean, is a huge part of how they're perceived. I mean, no doubt about it. If, Even people's names, are just, it's all wrapped up in the same thing. Maybe his name was off-putting to somebody. It would say, oh, that's a corny name or whatever. I don't really know, I didn't really have that bias, as I said, like when his people from his record label sent me his stuff.
Was he still like Easy Mac back then? Was he still like, I mean, how young was he at that point?
He was not he actually he might have been. I don't think he was Easy Mac anymore. I'm pretty sure he had already changed his name.
Because one thing that was interesting, and I will admit I read this book when it came out. Doesn't it talk about how he wasn't really certain this was going to be his full career until maybe he graduated high school, or there was like that he still had had some. He talked about maybe going to a religious path or something too.
I think in the book, I talk a little bit about he had written a lot. He actually had a blog that I don't think anybody really knows about, because it's kind of lost to the hands of the internet. And on the blog, it was like pretty revelatory with regards to how he was thinking about certain things at a fairly pivotal moment in his life, which was like right up to this is before kids, you know. I think this was when he was getting ready to put out the jukebox, and which was the mixtape before that, you know. And in that on that blog, he's talking a lot about, like, you know, maybe I'm gonna go to college, you know, like what is gonna happen with my life, right? It's like the thoughts of like a person who's like a senior in high school, and recognizes that they're about to hit a milestone in which they need to kind of figure things out.
And they have a
College is
harder choice than probably a lot, because he probably, as a smart kid, knew that this could all go away very quickly. You know that, you know it's, he didn't. I mean, he didn't know. It's
I mean, it's a interesting, you know, point and interesting kind of like question about it. I don't really know, you know, what the answer to that is, because there's a lot of different readings on that. Some person could see that and they could say it is a little bit of a privilege for you to be able to say, I can go to college or I can be a rapper.
right. I'm
Right.
thinking of it more in terms of me with OCD and anxiety, how like it would be a teeth-shattering decision for me. And there are much harder things. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's just like there is a
Unsack my
little
privilege for a second.
there no, I mean, there is a little bit of like some element of that, you know, you have to kind of, you know, sort of have in your mind, because we have to recognize at the end of the day, this is a guy who's rapping. He's in this genre, you know, filled with people who are, at the end of the day, you know, really have nothing, you know.
Right.
You know, now, of course, there are some rappers who, you know, went to college, right? Like J. Cole, he went to college, right? He went to St. John's, you
I'm
know.
a rapper that went to college. I'm a rapper that went to college. I went to BU.
There you go. So, I mean, it's not inconceivable that you could be a rapper and go to college. You know, but there are, like, you know, I don't know, like, what college, like, you know, NBA Youngboy, you know, it would be going to, right? I just don't see that in the cards for him. You know, I don't see Kodak Black going to college, you know. Like, so there was a little bit of a little bit of like a circumstantial, yeah, anxiety, but it also was what you know, I had to, like, in my own mind, recognize that it was a little bit of like a, yeah, you're at a crossroads, but that's a good crossroads to be at. And the crossroads in and of itself is reflective of your life, right?
That's a good point. Yeah.
And you have to kind of, like,
He
you
wouldn't have
know,
been there if he didn't want to be there. Like, he made that happen. So, you know.
yeah, so exactly. Like, and maybe if he didn't go to, you know, didn't go to college and the rap thing didn't pan out, you know, I'm not saying he would have been okay, right? Like, you
Right.
know, he maybe he'd be, you know, flipping burgers right now.
Right.
You know, like, there's a lot
A
of
lot of dead
rappers
end
that,
jobs in Pittsburgh, you know.
there's a, I know a lot of people doing, you know, driving Ubers who were rappers, like, you know,
Right.
20 years ago. You know what
Yeah.
I'm saying? Like,
And even
Uber.
Cappadonna was driving a cab, you know?
He was. And you could be a successful rapper and driving a cab. Exactly. Great point. You know? Yeah.
It's funny. You mentioned kids, and I never miss an opportunity to bring this up, but this one of the reasons that kind of dragged me in is that, unfortunately, there's nothing on this that really ties it together, but the kids mixtape is the movie Kids to me was such a pivotal, important film for me. And I'm just wondering, as somebody who's a New York guy, and did that film have any sort of impact on you? Because I think that was one of the things that kind of drew me in at first when I started getting into him, was I'm like, oh, kids, like he shared a similar love.
I thought that was a pretty interesting, you know, choice of a movie to kind of build a mixtape concept around. Kids, I think the reason why it kind of connected with me was, now I'm talking about the mixtape, was because Kids was more something of my generation. I just turned 42, You said you were 45.
Yeah, the movie kid. Yep.
Yeah, kids is a little more my generation, our generation. So to see that utilized, you know, by a younger rapper, at that time, you know, 2010.
Yeah, I'd be surprised people would be still watching it, you know, that it lasted that long, you know.
Well, it was a very
To people like us, we saw it as kids, it was a shocking movie. And to see it now as adults, it's almost like, holy crap, this is pretty shocking. It's like when I was 16 and I watched and saw 16-year-olds doing this stuff, it was like, oh, whatever. But now I see how young 16 is as 45, and I'm like, holy shit. And
Yeah,
it's
I
like
thought
half of
it
them
was.
are dead, and half of them are either winning or nominating Oscars, which is pretty wild. I get nominated for Oscars, you
Yeah,
know.
no, the kids from Kids. I mean,
Those are amazing stories. Yeah.
Harold Hunter is dead. You know,
Casper, whose
yeah,
name is.
he's passed away. And Harold Hunter, I never really knew him, but I had a lot of friends who were sort of in that downtown milieu, for lack of a better word, and they knew him, you know, and I think he was, I probably was even at parties and shit with him, you know, but he wasn't somebody that I knew because he was a little bit older than me. And maybe I would have come to know him just because at that time in my life, I hung out downtown a lot. But he passed away, I think, in 2007 or so, you know, so I could be mistaken. Maybe it's 2006. That was around the time, you know what I mean, when I feel like there was a little bit of, I guess you would call it almost like hipster culture, drug culture, downtown New York culture. A lot of that was sort of making its way onto the internet, you know, and New York was really like super popping at that time. The blogs and all that shit were, you know, just starting to really get going here. Digital photography was like sort of a new thing. And so there was a lot of party photography and people going out at night, and like you know, there was what you would call like mashup culture. You know, a lot of like open format DJing was kind of
Yeah.
becoming a new thing. It wasn't like,
The rise of Z Trip.
even, I mean, I'm thinking more of like, I'm thinking more of the guy from Pittsburgh, fucking,
Oh, I can
I'm forgetting his name.
yeah,
Girl
I'm
Talk,
certain.
Girl Talk, I'm thinking
Yes,
about.
Girl Talk, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you know, this is like a little bit of a blip on the radar of music history because now with the streaming companies and shit, everything is back in these genres. There's like hip hop over here, and it's like pop over here, you know. But in reality, like a lot of those genres don't even really exist anymore. And at that time, there was like, you know, technology had sort of unleashed all this stuff, right? You had like iTunes, you could just fucking download all these like DJ mixes. It was remixes everywhere, mixtapes. You know, the music business was kind of falling apart. And so people were kind of getting hip to a lot of like just shit that you wouldn't even know how they got into it. So Kids was like one of these things where I had to assume you it sort of floated some way via a bootleg or some shit,
Yeah.
right? And people in Pittsburgh were able to access it, you know, online somehow. They downloaded it or whatever. And
Like the
you
Spirit
know,
of Christmas South Park thing. It just somehow floated around and then it became huge.
totally. And you know, and now they see it and they're like, yo, this is just like us. Now,
Yeah.
me, when I saw Kids, I saw Kids a little bit after it came out. I actually was not, this probably has a lot to do with my own life, right? And not necessarily, you know, the life that is in the movie or even Mac Miller. But I didn't think the movie was that crazy because I actually knew a lot of people like
Yeah.
that, right? And it wasn't uncommon. You know, I myself started smoking weed when I was like 12. You know,
Yeah.
so if anything, it looked like a life that I knew. You know, it was like people being into hip hop, skateboarding and shit. I wasn't really into skateboarding, but obviously knew a lot of people that were into skateboarding. And Kids was a little more reflective of New York, like Manhattan culture. And Manhattan culture, this might even be like way off topic for this particular
That's cool.
podcast, but Manhattan culture and the rest of the, five borough culture is a lot different, and the way people, even the type of kids that would be in Manhattan and engage with like hip hop and weed and shit, I'm not saying it wasn't somewhat similar, but it was way different where I lived in Staten Island. I grew up around mostly black people, right? Kids is mostly white people, everybody in that, so that alone made me feel that I couldn't really necessarily relate to it, even though I did relate to those characters a little bit because I was a white kid, and I had friends who were doing somewhat crazy shit, but that was a little bit more something like you might have even looked at it a little bit funny, like, that just seems like,
It's like, why am I watching Friends and everybody's white?
Yeah, it was a little bit of like that kind of shit, it was weird, I it's an interesting thing. It's like I kind of, yeah, I knew some people like that, and I did understand it, and I did connect with it, but I also, I don't even know. It's deep. That's some deep New York. It's some deep New York, like five boroughs shit that, like, you almost would have to be from here to kind of understand what I'm saying.
Well,
Like,
that
but
movie's one of my favorite topics of conversation because there's so much interesting stuff about it, and people have different relationships to it. Because I came from a very small town where that to me was like, I mean, there was no one like, I mean, sure, some kids smoke weed when they're 12, but it's like my town didn't have cable till like 1992 or something, and I didn't have it, and I didn't have it personally till 2000. So it's like I was the exact opposite, sheltered of it. So that, but then I went right to rave culture, and it was like, one to the other. But
I mean, rave culture, even that, I would kind of understand it a little bit more because, again, we're in Staten Island, where I'm from, kids were into raving, and dance music is big in that. It is now, and it was then, you know what I'm saying? Like, Michael Caruso, is the one who brought techno and all that shit. He's from Staten Island. He's literally the one who brought techno to America. He got the shit from fucking like Europe. Well, I mean, obviously techno's from Detroit, but it was, it was blowing up in Europe, brought that shit back here, and in the 90s, I mean, this is all documented, right? I mean, there are books about him. He's the dude who literally brought that stuff to the limelight and all that, and this was kind of the fucking nexus for, what I'm saying, for that type of music to, sort of branch out into the rest of the country.
I think I have that book. It's called Generation Ecstasy, because I think I read it not that long ago, and it's triggering, like, because it's been on my shelf for years.
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that one. The one I'm thinking of is a book by this guy, Frank Owen.
That
And
sounds
it's
kind of
called
familiar.
the book is called Clubland. Frank
Oh,
Owen.
yeah, I
Frank
know the book you're
Owen.
talking
Frank
about.
Owen is he's a legendary journalist. He wrote a lot of those articles. He originally covered it for the Village Voice, and this is, in the era of like the Michael Alig and all that. So some of what I'm talking about is a little bit rooted in that, ecstasy and all that. I mean, that all is like out of borough shit to me. You know what I mean? It's not Manhattan stuff. It's like people don't even really know, like, those clubs is, the reality is, like, it was like half bridge and tunnel people, and then like the other half would be like Manhattan people, so a lot of that shit from like Kids and stuff, it's like, it's a little bit of a I feel like that was like the Manhattan version of that story, and I think even in that movie, which I have not watched in a long time, but there's like the whole scene where they're in the club, right? Close to Vignette's in the club and all that.
And the guy's giving her, and the dude's giving her the ecstasy, I think.
And like, you know, to me, I just, you know, I could see her doing it as a Manhattan kid, but I associate even the drugs with like whoever was giving it to her with just like somebody from Staten Island or somebody from deep in like South Brooklyn, you know, or the Bronx, you know. You know what I mean? It's a very like
The club, I've seen some club dealers up close. They didn't look like that guy. Like, put it that way.
I gotta really rewatch Kids. I have not watched it in a long time, but yeah, I mean, whatever. I'm just giving you the, you know, the point of view of, you know, of somebody who lived here, you know what I mean,
Yeah,
in that
that's
time,
why I
in
was
that time.
curious, because it's like I rarely get a chance to talk to people from New York, but like, because I went to film school because of Kids, Clerks, and Reservoir Dogs. It's like, those came out around the same time, and I was like, that blew my mind. It's like after a childhood of like E.T. and like all this other shit, when those came, I was like, oh, you can do stuff and it doesn't have to cost a lot of money and it can be really impactful. It's
I mean, in some sense, right? All of those are classic movies, right? They pretty much reinvented cinema.
Yeah. Throw Slacker in there with it,
I mean,
and do the right thing,
there's almost none of that stuff
House
now.
Party.
There's almost none of that stuff now. You know, we're back to fucking ET, right? We're in that generation again, where everybody is making kind of conventional movies. And it's like that too with the music, you know. And that's a little bit of the reason why even doing the book was, although it was difficult and at times, you know, depressing, just because of, you know, the sad nature of the, you know, of the subject matter itself. At times it was fun too, because, you know, you got to really like relive a moment in music when it was almost like the 90s in film, where people were reinventing the way they were going to deliver music, reinventing the kind of concepts. You could not make Kids now. Like, you can't make that mixtape because Larry Clark, you know, God bless the guy, he would have want to get paid for that cover, right? You couldn't clear those samples, you know, they would match you for, you know, for rhyming over those beats,
Well, is
right?
it, but don't they have to clear it now anyway, though, to do the re-releases? Or I mean, that stuff, like I know De La Soul finally. I know enough about music that I just try to avoid using samples and songs that I know people are gonna hear because I just don't want to deal with it. But like they must still have to deal with all that stuff.
I mean, yes, when they're, but that's the point I'm trying to make
Oh,
is
sorry.
that back then, these things weren't even really being commercially released. They were just giving these things away,
It's like
right?
it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I'd love to have that problem. It's like, yeah, bring that problem because that means somebody actually heard it. It's like cross that bridge when you come to it.
That was actually a little bit of reason why, you know, even though I don't really point to it in the book, because I made a little bit of a deliberate attempt to not, I really wanted to make sure that I didn't turn the book into like a series of essays where I was like lecturing people. But if you really look at it, that lawsuit with Lord Finesse for $10 million, it did kind of change a lot of things. People became a lot more conscious of what they were doing. There was a little bit of a shift that occurred almost like right after that, you know, where you didn't see people rhyming over beats and shit anymore like that. They kind of stopped because they recognized that they were going to get sued, you
I kind
know.
of stopped around that same time too, now that I think about it. And it's also just you also realize you're kind of betting against yourself. And if you want to put the music in the your effort in the music, don't bet against yourself by,
I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, but at the same time, right, it created this a little bit of a nostalgia vacuum, right? In the sense that you were able to connect with this kid who was doing some music that was based on something you knew and loved, you know, from 1993 or 1994 or 1995, whatever year, you know, that came out. And it kind of connected you to it, right? And you said, oh, wow, he's rhyming over this Lord Finesse thing. And it was familiar. And you were like, you know, it kind of drew you in. Now you can say, on the one hand, you could say Lord Finesse deserves to be compensated for that.
Right.
True.
Or you could say it's compensated by the exposure. You know,
Yeah.
it's.
By the same token, Lord Finesse, you know, his record was, there was a sample used on it, right? So
Right.
culture kind of builds on it, on other culture. And people kind of, you know, sort of use different things.
Little bit of a selective outrage sometimes when it comes to stuff like this.
Yeah,
Like, we all
totally.
hate it when Diddy does it, but if like Jadakiss does it, where it's like, you know, Jada's got a gun, no one's like yelling about Aerosmith, you
Oh man, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Love that album. Like, Jadakiss is my top five. I just, that dude, I would like his line on that, on the Gangstar song, invest. Well, I don't invest all my money in the haze and the dope because right now I'm currently a slave for Interscope. That's like one of the hardest bars ever. It's coming right out at your record label, like right out. Like, damn, Jada.
Yeah, Jada's a
And
special guy.
the 50 Cent diss, that is my favorite diss song of all time, you know.